sports, entertainment, and Maine's best guest list. On The Pulse, AM 620 WZON, WZONThePulse.com, and the WZON app. This is Downtown with Rich Kimball.
And a very good Sunday morning to you. Welcome in on this 17th day of December. Home stretch if you've got Christmas shopping to do. Or if you're like me and Carrie, you've either maybe not done it or aren't going to do it.
That's where I'm at.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten you a gift now. You're not
going to
get one.
Not going to get one. It's as simple as that. Or it will be homemade. We'll craft something in the downtown workshop for you. I'm still upset that the banana bread was gone.
Yeah, and I feel sort of bad that I mentioned it at all.
Yeah, tease me, telling me there's banana bread, but what do I expect? It's going to hang around at Sunday morning, for crying out loud. No, but crumbs, this one got me. The foil open, crumbs left in the foil.
Well, that's what happens. I was in here a half hour doing production, and that half hour, it disappeared.
Just like that. Well, we'll make up for it with a fine guest list on your Sunday morning Best of Downtown, which is brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Downtown's guests come your way, as always, on the G&M Family Market phone line. G&M is on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden, open every day of the week, 6 a.m. until 9 p.m. On the program this morning, we'll hear from syndicated advice columnist and author Amy Dickinson. The legendary Upton Bell will return visit with us this week. And we get things rolling this morning with a little baseball talk. Hall of Fame ballots are in the hands of the Baseball Writers Association of America's voters. Who should get in? Well, for that, we turn to America's expert on that subject. He's our friend Jay Jaffe of Sports Illustrated and SI.com and the author of the Cooperstown Casebook. Well, let's start with the guys who are in as of the announcement a few days ago. Jack Morrison, Alan Trammell. Any problem with either of those two going in?
Well, you know, I've been pretty down on Jack Morris for a long time. I was not particularly supportive of his candidacy. I thought that, you know, it was a conflation of factors centering around this very old school notion about what he represented rather than what he actually accomplished on the field. Certainly, the Game 7, 1991, 10-inning shutout for the Twins against the Braves in the World Series, I think that gave him kind of a larger-than-life reputation that really, you know, kind of dissolves if you look more closely at his overall postseason resume. It's basically a reflection of his regular season resume. He was terrible in 1992, and the Blue Jays won despite that. He failed to rise to the occasion in 1987 when the Tigers were steamrolled by the 85-win Twins in the ALCS. Mm. Alan Trammell, I'm happier about. I think that was a pleasant surprise. I mean, more than anything else, it was interesting that this process, the small committee process by whatever name, Veterans Committee, or ERA Committee, had not elected a living ex player since 2001. This year we got two of them. So that can give some hope to a lot of other players who fell off the ballot. I think there are many who are deserving of another look. I wrote a lot about them in the Cooperstown Casebook, and Trammell was one that I highlighted in particular. I hope that his former teammate and Morris's former teammate as well, Lou Whitaker, gets a look in this process at some point in the near future.
Yeah, absolutely. To me, the two of them not going in together is a bit of a crime. Up here in the Northeast, there was a lot of disappointment that Louis Tiant didn't get in. He was part of that modern era ballot. Did he have the numbers to justify that?
I'm not entirely sold on Louis Tiant. I love him as a character. I think he had several excellent seasons. I'm not sure he had enough quite to make him a strong Hall of Fame selection. That said, I wouldn't have complained too hard if he'd gotten in. I certainly have a great deal of affection for him. Just especially what he was with the Red Sox and just the character that he brought to the game, I think was a lot of fun.
Let's talk about some of the guys who are first-timers on the ballot this year. Among that group, who's, at least numerically speaking, ought to be a dead-set lock?
Chipper Jones and Jim Thome, both of them. I mean, Jones is one of the top 10 third basemen ever to play. Great contributor on both sides of the ball for the Braves dynasty there. Thome with over 600 home runs and thankfully a spotless reputation when it comes to performance-enhancing drugs. I think those guys will sail in easily.
And then you've got guys that are very interesting to me, like Scott Rolen and Johnny Damon. You know, the eye test tells me, no, probably not. But then you look at some of the numbers and even Rolen at his position, and maybe. What do you think?
Yeah, I love Scott Rolen as a candidate. In fact, I'm working on his profile for SI.com right now. I think he's also one of the top 10 third basemen of all time. Outstanding defender, one of the best ever in the field. Both the Gold Glove totals and the advanced metrics, I think, have him third all time at the position behind Brooks Robinson, and I think it's Adrian Beltre is the other one. I don't think he's going to get a ton of attention, though, and I worry he could slip through the cracks here, become one of those quote-unquote 5% guys who don't survive to the second ballot here. Maybe that's not the case. Early balloting, he's gotten 15% of the first 45 ballots cast here. So maybe he'll survive, but I think he's a strong candidate. I don't have that same feeling about Johnny Damon. Obviously, part of two big World Series wins with the Red Sox and Yankees, 04 and 09, gave 3,000 hits a run for his money. But, you know, as a center fielder, he was kind of adequate at best, did not add a lot of defensive value. And when you take the whole package into account, I think he was a very good, not quite great player, but certainly a lot of fun to watch during his heyday.
We're talking with Jay Jaffe, author of the Cooperstown Casebook here on Downtown. Omar Vizquel, very interesting case. He put up some pretty good offensive numbers because of the time he spent in the major leagues, and then, of course, the stellar defense.
Yeah, Vizquel's a guy who's, his proponents like to claim he's the best defender of all time or the best defender since Ozzie Smith. I don't know that that's really supported by the metrics, at least the ones that I'm looking at here. His offense, he was part of those Cleveland Indians powerhouses, but the offense just really isn't quite there enough to make his total value worth, measure up to the Hall of Fame shortstops that are already in using my system. The Jaws system, which uses wins above replacement. I mean, I think value-wise, he's about the equivalent of the worst Hall of Fame shortstop, or the lowest-ranked Hall of Fame shortstop. Let's not say worst. Rabbit Moranville. Certainly there's some flash there. It's just not quite a compelling enough package for me, particularly on a crowded ballot. He's a polarizing candidate like Jack Morris was. I mean, there's a lot of eye test type stuff. What were you watching? Get your head out of a spreadsheet type stuff. But I think, unfortunately, detracts from the debate somewhat. But very good player, part of some great teams. I just don't think he's quite measures up to Hall of Fame caliber.
I've heard people talk about Johan Santana and say, well, he's a little bit like Koufax. He had those years when he was dumb. And I said, well, you might want to go back and look at the numbers of Sandy Koufax, because Santana never approached that level of dominance.
No, but he had a very compelling peak there for a while, and with the two Cy Young Awards and all of that. I mean, Koufax, once you adjust for the run scoring environment of Dodger Stadium, Koufax's numbers wash out a little bit. Santana was pitching in a very difficult time, so they're actually not that unlike each other. However, Koufax also had the World Series, in which he was utterly dominant. ERA below one in I think it's nine starts overall. Santana, unfortunately, doesn't quite have that going for him. And, when you think about the steep obstacles that starting pitchers face on the Hall of Fame ballot, I mean, Mike Mussina and Curt Schilling can't get in. Both of those guys, I think, are superior candidates in the long run. Maybe not quite as dominant, individual seasons, but you look at how they excelled for so long. I would put them on my ballot before I put Santana. But, I do think there's an argument to be made for the latter.
Now, you don't do a Jaws for the baseball writers and show their credentials and whether they're worthy of having a Hall of Fame vote. But what are your guesses? What are your thoughts on how they'll go with a guy like Mussina this year, or people tainted by steroids like Bonds and Clemens?
Well, all three of those guys got above 50% for the first time last year. I think they're going to be trending towards election eventually here. It's obviously not going to happen this year because you've also got Trevor Hoffman and Vlad Guerrero, both of whom were holdovers. I think they missed by 5 and 15 votes respectively last year. But I do expect all three of those guys to make some headway here. Mussina, I think people are coming around on. He's got five more years after this to make it. Bonds and Clemens have four more years after this to make it. The Joe Morgan letter that was sent out by the Hall of Fame, this plea to not elect steroid users, I think I don't want to say it fell on deaf ears because people certainly heard it, but you know, it was a simplistic and disingenuous letter that ignored a lot of other issues, such as baseball's long history with amphetamines,
right.
Like steroids are a performance-enhancing drug, and which several Hall of Famers used, particularly during Morgan's time, but up until 2005. I don't think that the Morgan letter is going to deter people from voting for Bonds and Clemens. I haven't seen any evidence of that so far. So, you know, I expect they'll continue their slow climb towards 75%.
Do you think that Marvin Miller will someday get his due with the Hall?
Oh, boy, man. If there's one thing about the modern baseball ballot that really ticks me off, it's that, far more than the election of Jack Morris. Miller should have been in 20 years ago. It's purely politics that's keeping him out. You've got a block of executives, many of whom had links to either, let's just say many of them had links to labor wars of the past and are never going to give Miller the satisfaction or the Miller family the satisfaction of electing him. You know, he asked to be taken out of consideration before his death a few years ago, and in spite of that, the Hall keeps putting him on there. I don't think you can credibly tell the story of baseball without him. He's one of the most impactful non-players ever. You know, it really bothers me that he's not in, but not much to do other than hope that eventually the committee membership is the right one to really put his point across.
Jay, we always like to talk beer with you when we have you on the program. Have you had something lately that has caught your fancy?
Gosh, you know, I've actually been enjoying some from up in your neck of the woods there. For some reason, there have been Maine Beer Company beers turning up in my grocery store, which, you know, happens only once in a blue moon here. But it's only a couple varieties, but the Another One IPA really blows me away in terms of its quality. Just a nice light IPA, easy drinking, and you know, I even paying a premium cost for them, I'm like, oh boy, I can't get enough of this stuff.
Fantastic. Hey, Jay, always great to talk with you. Enjoy. If you haven't read it already, get the Cooperstown Casebook. It is such a compelling read. We always love having you on the show. Happy holidays to you and the family, Jay, and we'll catch up with you in the coming year.
All right, Rich, thanks, and happy holidays to you and yours and your listeners as well.
That is Jay Jaffe, author of the Cooperstown Casebook, talking Baseball Hall of Fame here on the Best of Downtown. When we return, we'll talk advice, and we'll talk dealing with all kinds of life challenges as well with nationally syndicated columnist Amy Dickinson. Up next, it's the Best of Downtown on the Pulse WZON.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's three times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
It may not be prime biking season, but it's always a good time to make sure your cycle is in great shape. And there's only one place to go to do that. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts. They offer outstanding service and a huge stock. Make sure you like them on Facebook to get updates, shop in person or online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
It's not always whether you win or lose, but who you've got on your team. The Emily Ellis team at Next Home Experience wants you to enjoy the best team chemistry in real estate. If you're looking to buy, sell, rent, or build in the Bangor area, make Emily Ellis's All-Star Squad your go-to team. Responsive and experienced, the Emily Ellis team will make your real estate quest as smooth as possible. Linda, Jen, Callie, and Emily will listen and prepare your game plan. The Emily Ellis team at 57 Washington Street in Bangor, shooting for your goals.
At Green Acres Kennel Shop, it's the most wonderful time of the year every time you visit.
They are your pet's home away from home, right?
Yes, and so much more. Green Acres is a full-service pet care provider. They're locally owned and have continually been voted best kennel, best pet store, best dog trainer, and best pet groomer in the greater Bangor area.
That's great. I recently went to a chain store and had a bad experience.
You won't at Green Acres Kennel Shop. Their staff are caring, compassionate, and dedicated.
I'll contact them today.
Green Acres Kennel is holding their annual Christmas sale now through Sunday, December 17th. All non-pet food items like books, bones, collars, cat toys, dog toys, grooming supplies, leashes, treats, and more will be 20% off all weekend. Shop local this holiday and experience the difference. Green Acres Kennel Shop, 1653 Union Street, across from Sprague's Nursery, your pet's home away from home.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, a home away from home.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. My company is ClearPoint Financial. We're an independent retirement plan advisory firm located right here in Bangor, Maine. At ClearPoint Financial, we provide guidance-based, comprehensive retirement plan solutions to companies that are concerned about their employees' retirement income security. We focus on plan participants. We help them strive to achieve retirement income security. We provide ongoing engagement, education, investment advice, and service that exceeds expectation. For more details on our financial wellness programs, call me today at 899-2552. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
It's the best of downtown here on the Pulse, AM 620, WZON.
I can see why you think you belong to me. I never tried to make you think or let you see one thing for yourself.
Rich Kimball, Carrie Haskell with you. Downtown brought to you by Quirk Auto Group and QuirkAuto.com. It's your car. Find it at Quirk. Our next guest on the show is a nationally syndicated advice columnist, Ask Amy. You'll also hear her on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And she's the author of a terrific new book entitled Strangers Tend to Tell Me Things. Our conversation from just a couple of days ago with Amy Dickinson here on Downtown. After reading the book, I hope you're getting a kickback from the Freeville, New York Chamber of Commerce because you make it sound like such a wonderful place to live.
Oh, no. You know, people always tell me that, and that's when I realize how often we layer on our own sort of dreams, visions, and feelings, especially about small towns, because Little Freeville, where I am right now, where I grew up, is not a cute little, it's not the Gilmore Girls, you know what I'm saying? It's like, and Maine is full of towns like this.
Oh, yes.
And upstate New York is full of towns like this, and Vermont is full of towns like this. And I live in one of those little villages where you drive through and you look around and you think, well, what are these people doing here? You know, like, why?
Well, they're living lives of, I think, great beauty and complexity.
As it turns out, that's exactly what we're doing, isn't it? And that's why I remember when I first wanted to write a memoir, and I spoke to my agent, and I said, like, now, what? Like, I'm not a heroin addict. I haven't had, you know, these super, super dramatic things happen. Now, who wants to read a book about an sort of an ordinary person? And she said, everyone.
Well, yeah, because you have dealt with the challenges, the struggles, the highs and the lows that so many people have. And a big part of the book talks about what it was like being a single mom for quite some time. And that's not easy, but it certainly is something that so many people can relate to.
Yeah, actually, and what I hear most often about this book is how relatable it is because, you know, I think people have this idea about advice givers. I certainly probably had this idea about Ann Landers, you know, or Dear Abby. This notion that people who give advice lead lives that are sort of twinkly and perfect. And what I really wanted to do was to pull back the curtain on that and show people what an ordinary life I actually do lead. But it's like anybody else's life. It's full of incident, because if you live in a family, you're surrounded by drama and heartbreak and hilarity and everything in between.
Well, and one of the things you say in the book is that why you feel like you're able to give advice to people is because you've lived through many of the same experiences that they often ask about.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's this quote I love, Erik Erikson, the famous psychologist or psychiatrist. There's a quote from him that I really love, and it says, experience is for me the best teacher. And I think that any of us, if we are paying attention, can learn the most really from the lessons delivered by our own lives and our own experiences. But you have to really pay attention.
We're talking with Amy Dickinson here on Downtown. One of the parts of the book I enjoyed so much was following the courtship with you and your now husband, Bruno. And there are challenges that, the idea of finding love later on, a second time in life, is rife with challenges. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, and I mean, it was quite something really stepping into what I think of as the plot of a Hallmark movie. You know, it's like this, I had been single. I had been a single mom for almost 20 years. And when I moved back to my little hometown, I moved to Freeville from Chicago to take care of my mother at the end of her life. And I hired somebody to renovate the house, and in walked Bruno. And in the book, I describe it like John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara in The Quiet Man. You know, it was really quite shocking. The best part, in some ways, of that whole story is that I was very happy and prepared to live my life without a partner. And I was really good with that. And I'm not saying that, like, oh, the universe delivered, you know, right when I least expected it. But it was more like over many, many years, I realized I had gotten good at leading my own life, making my own decisions, forming my own friendships. And I truly was, I mean, I, you know, went through periods of feeling quite lonely for a partner, but I was definitely feeling pretty good about my own life. And that's, I think, important.
And who knew that his decision to simply not go for a walk with you might lead to where you are now?
I know. Bruno played kind of hard to get, can I say? You know, it was, but, you know, we were two sort of over-the-hill, middle-aged plus people, and he was really wary. I had simply had much more experience, frankly, in relationships than he had, and I think I saw the stakes a little differently than he did. But yeah, no, he played really hard to get.
Now the compliment he gave you was, if I remember it right from the book, was that you're reliable.
I know. Imagine that. How romantic.
But he seems like the most reliable man. I'm in love with Bruno from reading the book. He's a rock.
He is a doll. Look, Bruno and I both grew up on dairy farms. He is one of 13 children. And there's a fact, when you're farming, you have to show up and do the milking, you know? And so I think Bruno and I are both, and look, I think if you asked anybody, reliability really is a core value for a lot of people, because if you're reliable, it means that people can count on you, you know? And so I was a little shocked when he delivered this as some kind of on a romantic platter. But then when I thought about it, I realized that, like, that is really important to him and to me. And what do you know, after we got married, my reliability was really, really, really put to the test, because I entered into a family with four new stepdaughters, all in the throes of adolescence. There was a lot of door slamming. There's a lot going on.
Also, I thought an incredibly poignant aspect of the book was talking about your mother, the late days of her life, her passing, and then your struggle to deal with the grief that followed that. Was it cathartic in any way for you to write about those times?
I have to say, it was incredibly cathartic, but it did not. One of the points I make in my chapters about my mother and about her death and grieving, one of the points I make is that, for me anyway, closure is a total crock, and it was incredibly important for me to write about her and to write about my experience with her. And I think this is the experience a lot of those of us sort of nearing 60 are dealing with. Children, on the one hand, needing us, our elderly parents needing us. You know, millions of Americans relocate at this stage of life to be with elderly parents, and so it's a very common experience. But I was not prepared for the loss, even though I was there. You know, you think you're ready, but I was not prepared for it, and I still feel it. I'm so happy I wrote about it. It was so hard to write. Oh, that chapter took me a month to write.
Oh, I'm sure. And I love what you say about family as well, that it's about surrendering to the moments that are out there and just embracing, I think you put it, those fleeting moments when everyone is healthy and happy.
Exactly. Any of us who have been through, you know, if you're involved with people, then that means that you will get hurt because you or they will get sick or something will happen. And yes, I have definitely, I've always been somebody who sort of liked to look at the sunshine and all that. But I, even more, I'm so grateful for just those everyday events. You know, I'm in our little village choir and we're practicing for a Christmas cantata. And I have to say, there's nothing more beautiful than a ragtag group of rusty singers practicing for Christmas. You know, it's a very timeless experience, and that sort of thing makes me incredibly happy.
So what says home to you, Amy? Is it that sense of place, or is it the people in it, or can they even be separated?
You know, for me, because my family has lived literally on the same land for since 1790, really, I think they're very, very intertwined, the people and the place. And one of the reasons I was very happy to write this book is, in some ways, it really is, it's a thank you note to the people who helped to raise me. You know, the people I went to high school with, their parents, the guys that run our grocery store. You know, just these good people who I've been lucky enough to know.
We're talking with Amy Dickinson. Her new book is entitled Strangers Tend to Tell Me Things. Do your friends ask you advice, or do they just say, oh, no, it's Amy, she's not going to help us?
You know, I don't like to really offer unsolicited advice. And I think that people... One thing I can do, honestly, after 15 years of doing this job, I can definitely point people to resources, but I really try not to leap in unless somebody seeks me out. And the fact is, people do seek me out, and friends do occasionally ask me, oh, in fact, just today, somebody called me up and asked me, oh, this person wants this big favor, I'm not sure, and I said, here's how to say no to that. You know, because that, you know, I've gotten more practiced at a lot of these techniques over the years.
It's the holiday season, always a time of stress for everybody. My wife, my son and I just moved to a new house. For any situation people are in, what's the best way to enjoy the holidays? Because we have to get some advice out of you while you're here.
Oh, well, and I love this topic, actually. You know, for me, it's to do things and to try to remember to do things. And that means go ice skating, go, you know, go caroling or listen to carolers or go to your community's tree lighting or, you know, it's for me, the most memorable moments are those when I have done something Christmassy. But it's hard. It's like we're so busy, we forget to do those things.
Now, we're asking all of our guests here this week if they have a favorite Christmas song. Is there one tune? You mentioned you're in the choir. Is there a song that just says Christmas to you?
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. It's not a carol, but I love it so much.
And I not only love the song, I love the movie, too. Meet Me in St. Louis.
Incredible. Incredible.
Well, Amy, the book is so good. We love your work on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And, of course, Ask Amy. It's a real delight for us to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. Such a pleasure. Thanks.
And we wish you and Bruno and the extended family a wonderful holiday season.
Same to you. Thank you.
That's Amy Dickinson, author of Strangers Tend to Tell Me Things. On the Best of Downtown for a Sunday morning. When we return, Upton Bell was on with us last week. We had so much fun. Had to invite him back. We did. He said yes. And you'll hear the fruits of that labor up next here on The Pulse, WZON.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind. Identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
At this busy time of year, there's nothing better than a place that offers you one-stop shopping. That place is G&M Family Market on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Fresh produce delivered daily, a great selection of meats and seafood, beer and wine, of course a Dunkin' Donuts and an Amato's right on site. Stop into G&M Family Market every day of the week from 6 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and if they don't have what you're looking for, they'll make every effort to get it next time. G&M Family Market, Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden.
There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
Go Blue!
Sir, you're here for the cheerleading tryouts?
Yeah, for the class of 82. Gotta show my school spirit.
I know a better way. The UMaine Alumni Signature Rewards Visa Card from University Credit Union. Low rates, no annual fees, and it earns reward points for travel, merchandise, or cash back.
Woo, sounds easier than a backflip.
Apply online today at UMaineAlumniCard.com.
Federally insured by NCUA. Terms and conditions apply, subject to credit approval.
Polaris is now at Friend and Friend in Orono. Polaris side-by-sides, Polaris Rangers, Polaris Razors, Polaris ATVs, Polaris snowmobiles. The Polaris factory authorized clearance is going on now, with massive rebates up to $2,500 on non-currents, making now the time to buy. On-the-spot financing. Get your off-road vehicle today at Friend and Friend Polaris in Orono. Easy on, easy off. Exit 193 on I-95, just 5 minutes from Hogan Road. Polaris at Friend and Friend in Orono, now. Sunday morning, Best of Downtown. Rich Kimball, Carrie Haskell, with you. on the Pulse, AM 620 WZON.
That's life.
That's life.
That's what all the people say.
Our next guest on Downtown visited with us last week. We had so much fun. We invited him back. He said yes, and so Upton Bell joined us along with Bruce Pratt for another special edition of Sports Lit 101 here on Downtown.
Quick story, I'm just listening to Sinatra. My second year with the Patriots, I get a letter from Sinatra. Upton, I'd like a Patriots jersey. At that moment, we hadn't won a game. So I told the woman who was handling the mail right back, very honored, Frank, but why the hell would you want our jersey? and that was it. Actually, I met Sinatra a couple of times. Fascinating person, but not as fascinating as Stephen King. There is nobody more fascinating than him.
But that's why we played that Sinatra song as a lead-in to the Sinatra story, but you didn't need any more setup than Frank himself.
Are you kidding me? Life's nothing but a stand-up act.
Well, let's talk about the owner of our station, Stephen King, and you know him quite well. I've worked with him a lot through the years, and you've got some very interesting stories about him.
Well, the first time, it's ironic, 1990, that I met Stephen, I just finished doing an interview with George Herbert Walker Bush at the White House, and I said to Bob Lobel and the people at Channel 4, I said, you know, the most fascinating person is not the president, it's Stephen King. And I said, I have this idea. I said, I've never talked to him before, but I'll call Marcia, and I assume that Marcia is still with Stephen. And
yes.
I said, I will propose this. Now, remember, the Red Sox had broken hearts in New England for many years, so I pitched it to Marcia. I said, here's what I'd like to do. Stephen is going to be in Boston. He's going to go to the game tonight that will determine, I believe, whether the Red Sox make it into the playoffs that year. I said, what I'd like to do, he was staying at the Boston Harbor Hotels, take a camera crew over there and interview him and base it on the story of Moby Dick, the search for the great white whale. And he loved the idea. And so I said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to interview him basing the Red Sox being Moby Dick, the great whale, and of course, Ahab is we, the stupid fans. So we did the interview, and it was absolutely great. He came to the game that night, and actually we showed him on the monitor down on the field the introduction and the interview. And then we went up into the WBZ private box. And here's something that your audience might not know about Stephen. He said, here are the ground rules. He said, when the inning is taking place, I don't talk about anything. The only time that I will discuss anything with you, and he said I'm open to anything, is between the innings. So, you know, the Red Sox would bat, and then you know you wait for 4 or 5 minutes till the next team came up. I think they were playing the White Sox, or it might have been Toronto. So you had about 5 minutes each time in between each inning to talk to him. I said, this is really hilarious. So between each inning, as we worked our way up to the ninth inning, I was telling him, I said, Red Sox, they're lousy. They shouldn't be in the playoffs. And I listed a whole bunch of reasons why. I said, the right fielder stinks. He isn't the same as Dwight Evans, so on and so forth. So at the end of the game, the Red Sox did pull it out with a very dramatic catch in right field. And with that, you know, Stephen was with his driver. And he said, I'm going home. And he said, I'll see you sometime. I swear to God, one day later, a book arrives here, The Dark Self. And with it, and I have it right up on the wall here, framed, everything that I said to him. That was wrong, he repeated back to me in this letter. You said they weren't going to go anywhere. Here's what they did. You said the right fielder wasn't going to do this. Here's what he did. And went line by line. Now, you think about the memory of somebody, because it was just casual conversation, and I was having a great time with it. But he had a letter. He sent it to me directly the next day. And every one of the things I said, he remembered, and then he said, this is the alternative to it. It's really amazing. I said, I've had that since 1990, so we're talking about 27 years. And many times he would, when I would be doing a football show, the Super Bowl one year, I called and I said, would you please get us off the hook? I have to do 5 hours. And he came on and just was terrific. Not only talking about baseball, but talking about anything. And ironically, he ran into Dan Shaughnessy. And at that time, I was doing a show called Sports Beat with Bob Ryan, Bob Lobel, and Joe Fitzgerald. And it was the biggest TV show of its time, a forerunner of all of the things you see today.
Right.
So King said to Shaughnessy, he said, yeah, I've been watching Upton Bell, he said, now a lot. And he said, you know, he reminds me of Ted Bundy. I said, Jesus, what a compliment. But that, you know, that was Stephen King. Last time I saw him in person, God, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, he was appearing with a band that went around the country. I know one of a band of authors. One of them was Amy Tan, is a very, very famous.
Dave Barry, the Rock Bottom Remainders.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I have to tell you, fellas, I've never heard worse music in my life, but... The participants were so colorful and so good. I'm trying to remember the instrument Stephen played, and I went back
guitar
backstage. Yes, afterwards, and of course you can't tell somebody what the hell was that I just heard. But it was really great. I mean, just listening to all of these famous authors and Stephen and their band. And I don't know how long they had the band. What, a year, 2 years, something like that. They would make appearances here and there, but they sold out. I'm trying to remember the venue here in Boston.
Yeah, and they
sold it out immediately because everybody wanted to see Stephen King and this band perform. So there's some of the stories about him. And you know, it's interesting because if I'm sitting here and the Shawshank Redemption is on, I must have seen it 40 times. And think about a prolific writer who has written not only great books with incredible characters, but practically every one of them were made into the movie. So I'm sitting here one night, somebody called me and said, have you seen Stephen King's new movie, TV movie, Storm of the Century? I said, no. I said, if I knew it was on, you know, because I watch anything that he puts on there. And he said, well, you're the sheriff in the movie. I said, you've got to be kidding.
That's right.
He said, no. He said, Upton Bell is the sheriff. He said, you're probably going to look like what he looks like. He's kind of fat and balding. And I think the sheriff was always cheating with somebody in the town. And I said, that's my man, Stephen.
Well, you
and
know.
So I actually got the book, and I got him to sign the, you know, he wrote the companion book to the movie, and I got him to sign it along with The Dark Self. But you know what? On my deathbed, I'm going to be saying, remember that fat ball sheriff. as I go into the next life, if there is one, I want to be the storm of the century. That's it.
Well, one of the most remarkable things about the book are all the people that you have met. And it struck me as I was reading the epilogue, that you actually sat in the Athletics dugout in Philadelphia with Connie Mack and saw Joe DiMaggio, Bob Feller, as you mentioned, Robinson, Willie Mays, the guy you thought was the greatest player of all time. Do you feel like you have really bridged two or three generations of important sports figures?
Well, it's not only important sports figures. Remember, in the book, and I hope people will get the book and really read the history. Because, gentlemen, it's the history of this country. Remember, my mother was one of the most famous actresses in America. In fact, if your audience goes online and types in Frances Upton and types in one of the first talking movies ever made, Night Work, you'll see my mother at the age of 24 dancing in the movie. She knew Lindbergh. She knew all of the great people of the century. As you read in the epilogue, she ends up going to a dinner with Al Capone and Machine Gun Ned McGurn and wonders why all of the people that are in show business, their backs are to the opening of the door and why the gangsters are all with their backs to the wall. And she's asking Capone, oh, Mr. Capone, why are we sitting on this side? Of course, he just smiles and blows cigar smoke in her face. But she, in some ways, actually was the reason the NFL is around today. And I'll tell you why. First of all, Burt Bell invented the draft, and if he had not, that probably wouldn't have been. But she's the one that convinced my father, who was a great quarterback at Penn, and then went on to coach in college football. His father owned all sorts of hotels and things. He was the Trump of Philadelphia without being Trump, thank God. He met her at a party in New York, and I believe that Lindbergh was at the party. And he began to pursue her over 2 or 3 years. And at that time, she was engaged to Bernard Baruch, the famous financier's son. And she broke the engagement and convinced my father to basically, she said, the pro game's it. She said, have you seen the Galloping Ghost? Have you seen Red Grange? Have you seen the Monsters of the Midway, George Halas? And so they began to date, and they went to the pro games, and eventually, make a long story short, they secretly got married. Walter Winchell, the famous gossip columnist of the time, broke the news. They got married on the church steps in Philadelphia. She gave him $2,200. They went down to the bankruptcy court in Philadelphia, bought the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets with her money. On their way back, they saw the National Recovery Act Eagle up on a big sign, and he said, that's going to be the name of the team, and that's where it all started. They end up living in his father's hotel, and I actually was born and lived in that hotel, the Ritz-Carlton in Philadelphia, which is in a segment of the NFL this year when they celebrated the anniversary of Burt Bell inventing the draft. So there are... You can't believe how many women have came up to me and said, geez, I thought it was, you know, a football book and about the country, but they never realized what an important role Frances Upton played in the NFL and its future.
We're talking with Upton Bell. His book with Ron Borges, Present at the Creation, My Life in the NFL and the Rise of America's Game. We would be remiss not to mention the horrific accident that you were in not all that long ago, and recovery from that continues. And is it safe to say that you walked your way back to good health?
Well, I would like to tell, again, your audience, the first thing is I never would have survived the first night if I wasn't in good shape. And I've worked out practically every day my whole life. At the time, I had broken my neck in 2 places, fractured my spine in 39 places, broke all my ribs, and had a severe concussion. And the doctors wanted to operate, but then they said, you know, he could die on the table. So I lived, and for 6 months, I was in a rehab place, and finally when I got out, I was, and this is the lesson about the opioid scandal and crisis, I was taking 100 micrograms directly into my skin of fentanyl, which is the most deadly drug you can take. But I had to take it because the pain was so severe. There's nothing they can do when you've crushed your body like that. So what I began to do was, in the hospital, walk and walk as much as I could, as much as I could stand. And then when I got home, you have to come down off to 100 micrograms over 3 months, because if you try to come down too quickly, you're either going to be a drug addict, or if you come down, it's very severe. You're very sick every day. There's a lot of things going on. So I decided that every time that I was in pain or sick, I would get up and go out and walk the back streets the places I could find. And I found that if I walked 3 hours, it would give me 3 hours of relief from the severe pain. So they sent me to a pain clinic at the Mass General Hospital. And they are now studying the whole idea that to get off drugs, that if you're willing to exercise a certain amount, it's almost the same endorphins that are in drugs that you use that can help you do it. But the final thing, a gentleman that really helped me was they sent me to see, ready for this, a Buddhist monk. And the Buddhist monk said, and this really struck home with me, he said, the minute you realize that there's certain parts of your body that will never get better, that will be the moment that you will begin to really heal. And he's absolutely right. You know, we can't be dreamers about certain things in life. We see it in athletics. We see it everywhere. Whether it's a broken body or a broken mind, if you look at something and say, all right, this is what I can live with, this is what I can do, but basically these are parts of me that are never going to recover, it's a positive message. And that's when I really began to get a lot better.
You know, Bert, we talked last week about the 1958 championship game, and I just happened to get a new book called Replays, Rivalries, and Rumbles by Steve Geitschire, which has a great article in it on that game by Dick Crapo, who's a good friend of the show and longtime longtime SLA member. And he said something in here that I think was really interesting, and it not only supports what you said, but it says, what really made football was not just that was a game, because as a game, it wasn't that great a game. It was a great thing to happen, but that your father understood that when that game got on television, and television and then later Sports Illustrated paying attention to pro football, that made all the difference in the world. The game itself, how it came out, how it got played out, didn't make as much difference as the fact that an exciting overtime game was on TV, and it was your father who pushed the other player, the other owners, to want to be on television.
Well, actually, a whole book, what's his name, who wrote Black Hawk Down, the famous author, has written a book, it's about 15 years old, and he calls it the greatest game ever played. In fact, he just wrote another book called Way, about the Vietnam battle that kind of settled that war in some ways. And he spends the whole beginning of the book talking about Burt Bell and the contributions he made, in particular not only the draft and many other things, but he's the one that fought the owners on two areas. One, you know, the NFL was going to close down during the Second World War. And my father said, as one of the owners at that time, he said, I'm going to tell you, if we close down, we'll never open again. So you better make up your mind now. If you close it, it's all over. That was the first thing. The second thing he pushed through later on is he said, in those days, the All-Star game was the biggest thing in football. When the champions of the NFL played the college All-Star game in Chicago, because I was at one of the first games, you had near 100,000 people at Soldiers Field. And so he said to the owners, you know, what happens if the game ends up in a tie? What will we do, flip a coin to send the whatever team wins? He said, that would make our league look ridiculous. He said, let's put in a sudden death overtime. He said, it'll add to the drama of the game. And see, he understood television even back in the 40s and early 50s, said that he felt that the most perfect TV game, because of the timeouts, the pace of the game, that it was made for TV. So when that came in 1958, you're absolutely right. The game, it looked like the Colts were going to run away with it. And then there was a fumble before the end of the first half, or it would have been 17-3. But the idea that at that time, that game, and that overtime. In fact, the Giant players didn't know what overtime was.
They didn't know what to do.
Okay, the tie, the game ends, and that's it. And that's where you'll see, if you see the old films of the game, is and there's a great shot of Yanis coming out as one of the captains and the Giants captains. And of course, the other thing that helped is that they were going to start the overtime. But the NBC, I think it was NBC, their plug or something happened. Some people think it was pulled on purpose. And there was a long delay. And then as they're about to start the overtime, it comes back on your TV screens again. But if that game didn't occur at that time, baseball would have taken another 10 years, maybe never, for the NFL to achieve that fame. So it is also a lesson, like reading a Stephen King book in some ways. One act, one murder, one sentence changes everything. That one game saved and changed the NFL. But if you knew, and of course people wouldn't know, if you knew Bert Bell, he had one of those brilliant minds, and yet he talked out of the side of his mouth. You'd say, who the hell is this Doc Walliper? But it was amazing. I was there, and again, here's the kind of ironies of life. I had gone to many of the championship games as a kid, and my father had called me and said, are you coming up for the game? And I said, I don't know. I said, is Joe DiMaggio going to be there? And he said, well, I think so. I said, okay, I'm coming. That's the only reason I went to the greatest game ever played and sat there on the 50-yard line and watched this drama unfold. So all of those things, and remember, which is a lot different than today, there was a newspaper strike in New York, so there was no advanced publicity. It was just, you know, another championship game. The Colts playing the Giants in New York, it was big because it was New York and it was Yankee Stadium. But there was a total newspaper strike, so this had to rely on television. And, of course, had one of the great endings, and the game saved everything in history.
Upton Bell with Ron Borges, the author of Present at the Creation. It is an absolutely wonderful book. It's been a delight for us to chat with you again this week, sir. We appreciate you making time for us, and hope you and your family have a wonderful holiday season, and we hope to do it again before too long.
Thank you very much. I'll see you at Shawshank Prison.
That is Upton Bell, author with Ron Borges of the wonderful book Present at the Creation, joining us here on the Best of Downtown. Our thanks to him, along with Jay Jaffe of Sports Illustrated, the author of the Cooperstown Casebook, and Ask Amy herself, nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Dickinson, for joining us here, and of course you, for making us a part of your weekend. Carrie and I will retreat to the workshop to finish up all of the things that Santa has on the list for us. We hope the rest of your Sunday goes well. Please be sure and join us tomorrow afternoon. We'll be here on Downtown, among other guests, Alan Adams of the Main Edge, Mike Lowe of the Portland Press Herald, and the Boston Globe's Chad Finn. We'll see you next time on Downtown. Casey's next with American Top 40 here on WZON. You're gonna be